You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition, 2, 1, 0, we have a liftoff. We have a liftoff and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Books in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico. Today we're going to do something a little different. I asked around a while back through various social media about the idea of occasionally doing a show here or there in which I talk to you, the audience, alone, without a guest, about topics that seem of some significance or other to me at the time. People seemed to think this was not a bad idea. And so the first topic that I really wanted to explore is the origins of my science fiction universe, particularly Lucian, Hawk, and the new Shattering Trilogy, the third volume of which should be along in the summer of 2014. This is a very exciting thing for me because, as you're about to discover, this is a project that really I've been preparing and working toward and trying to complete for many years. And my own growth as a writer, as a creator, has had to develop in order for this project to really be brought to fruition in the manner that it has. Now, I hope that you will forgive me for being egotistical enough to make this a topic, but I think that some people will be interested. If not, there are lots of other episodes in the series that you can go and certainly check out. But I'm just going to talk for a little while here about some of the influences, the origins and influences of the Shattering Trilogy, my characters, and this science fiction universe that I've sort of built in parallel to my probably slightly better known superhero series, The Sentinels. So maybe I'll do an episode later on with influences on this of this that went into The Sentinels. But today let's just stick to the Shattering, Hawk, Lucian, and books that maybe be coming out in the future. And I'll try to avoid spoilers at all costs for those. So, and I have to sort of, by the way, tip my hat to some of the people who have influenced me in terms of podcasting in this way. I don't know that I ever would have thought of doing something like this, but there have been a variety of podcasters over the last few years who have really opened my eyes to the possibilities of this medium. And I think first and foremost on that list is Michael Bailey of the Views from the Long Box podcast. His show is almost entirely about comic books and superheroes and sort of comics related peripheral to it, media. But Michael has done a number of episodes where he sort of just introspectively discusses things that are important to him in terms of entertainment and gives sort of autobiographical looks at how he came to those things, how he feels about them, why he feels the way he does about them. And I find those shows of his to be absolutely riveting, to be fascinating, to get a look sort of inside the mind of a very intelligent reader and aficionado of some of the same sort of material that I enjoy. You know, just sort of seeing what makes him tick and what makes him like the things he likes and why. And so I thought that I would just sort of use that as a jumping off point for what I intended to do today. Okay, so enough with the preliminaries. Let's get into it. The Shattering is a trilogy of science fiction novels that I have written over the past roughly 2 years. I believe I began it early in 2012, 2013, and its origins lie far, far back in my life, though. So let me go back. We've got to go all the way back to about 1983, 84. Early in high school, I wrote what was probably my second novel, quote-unquote. I had written a fantasy book that was entirely derivative of both Lord of the Rings and The Sword of Shannara, which is what everybody, you know, of my generation and my the group that I ran with, so to speak, was reading back then. And I wrote that in eighth grade in longhand, pen and ink, on notebook paper in a binder. And actually, several people read it and enjoyed it. It was sort of amusing that people actually did. And but of course, it was terrible. But it was clear to me even then that I wanted to write novels. Not even short stories, because I feel like short stories are very limited. Short stories, I've always said, are set up to do a trick. A short story is like a dog that has been trained to roll over or play dead or leap through a hoop. A short story is very concise. It's like a stage play where every single thing that's in it is critically important. Every element is important to the outcome of the story. And so a short story goes ba-dump bump, right? It does something, performs a trick, and the reader goes, oh, I get the trick, and the end. A novel is much, not just much longer, obviously, it's much longer, but a novel is much more, or can be much more expansive. It allows for much larger ideas to be slowly developed and played out. It allows for relationships to appear and to develop and to complicate and to reach some form of climax. It allows for the reader to become invested in the characters and their plight and not just be entertained by the trick of a short story. So I really think of novels and short stories as very, very different endeavors and as very, very different types of entertainment beyond just one is longer than the other. I think that's merely a symptom of the difference, maybe, so to speak. So I always knew I wanted to write novels. There was never any doubt in my mind that that's what I wanted to do. And so in 10th grade, around 83, 84, I wrote another novel, this one more of a science fiction novel, which I at the time called Seeds of Empire. And this I actually typed on an electric typewriter. It was very heavily influenced by things like Alan Dean Foster's Flinks and Pip books, Larry Niven's Known Space books, you know, all the things I was reading in 9th and 10th grade. And it actually was the first time I used this particular archetypal duo of leading characters, Flynn and Gallus. And this was a sort of a normal-sized guy with dark hair who was more the brains of the operation, and then a big, burly, blonde-headed guy who was more the muscle. And I even gave Gallus a fancy sword. And so the idea of the pairing of the dark-headed guy that's a little smarter and the big, muscular, blonde-headed guy with a sword has been an element running through my works from the very beginning. You see echoes of it in many of the things that I've done, most recently, of course, with Tamerlane and Agrippa in The Shattering. And it only occurred to me fairly recently that that's what I had done, that I had brought that same archetypal duo. It's like, you know, there back in my formative years in the late 70s, we saw a lot of TV shows that had, to some degree, that sort of duo. You had Starsky and Hutch. You had Starbuck and Apollo. You know, this was a pairing that we were even noticing and commenting on. I remember when I was in fifth grade with some of my friends, and it just sort of stuck with me, I guess. And so I had the two guys working together, in that book in 1983-84. I typed it, and I actually sent it off to some publishers. Of course, nothing but rejection letters, of course. Why else? What else would I get? But I remember that the editor of Timescape Books, which was at that time Pocket Books' new science fiction imprint named after the Timescape novel of, I believe, I want to say Michael Bishop, but I think he did No Enemy But Time. There was another author that did Timescape, and I'm sure many of you listeners, if you're interested in this material at all, will know who I'm talking about, but I'm not going to take the time to look it up now. But Timescape Books from Pocket Books was public, they were entering the market at that time, and I sent it to them, and they actually sent me back a whole personalized typed letter in reply, going point by point, naming my characters and giving suggestions and criticisms, and it was wonderful. I mean, it was depressing to a little kid who, to him, just saw rejection, but it was also, in retrospect, really remarkable that they would take the time to read something that, I mean, they probably didn't even realize it was coming from a ninth grader. And so they took their time. If the editor had known it was a ninth grader just sending something he'd typed on his back porch on an electric typewriter, he probably wouldn't have even wasted his time to reply, maybe. But he did, and it gave me encouragement. And, you know, the rest of high school and on through college, I didn't do a whole lot. I didn't read comics. I didn't read even hardly many science fiction novels. Some, but not many. And I didn't write much, but in 1990-91, after I graduated from college the first time, I had, you know, a few months before I started graduate school, and I was just working a part-time job in Auburn. And so I started making a concerted effort to reread the books that had had the biggest impact on me and study what it was that the authors did to make them so effective and to have such a profound impact on me. And I remember that the book I fixated on the most during that period, and that I had really tried to break down and understand what it was the author was doing that was so successful, was Roger Zelazny's Isle of the Dead. Now, Zelazny by the late 80s had become firmly entrenched as my all-time favorite science fiction / fantasy writer. In fact, one of the things that's very appealing about Zelazny is that he is a science, or was, he passed away in the 1990s, like 95, 96, but one of the things that made him so wonderful as a writer was that he could effortlessly move between fantasy and science fiction better than I can think of anybody else that could do that or ever has. And so, you know, his Amber books certainly were humongously influential on me. Lord of Light and Creatures of Light and Darkness and others as well, Road Marks. But Isle of the Dead I had just read, and it had really stuck with me for some reason. In part, I think, because it had, as usual with him, that interplay of gods and men who became gods or had godlike powers. And, you know, that has echoes that run through comics and superheroes and all that. And so that really all struck a chord and sort of glued all those various types of stories together in my mind, this idea of the god-man, the humans with flaws who are granted godlike powers. I've always been fascinated by that. And so, and of course, the themes of immortality that run through a lot of Zelazny's stuff have always fascinated me too. And so I broke down how he had written it. I just went line by line and studied the language, studied the sentence structures, the types of words he used, the way he put words together. See, I'm a very big believer in what I call the musicality of language. I feel like timing and rhythm play a large role in how something reads. I've always read fairly slowly because I read to appreciate not only what the story is telling me, you know, the plot and the characters, but also the way it's written, the musicality, the rhythm, the timing. You know, it's sort of like in doing comedy, timing is the most important thing. You have to space things out properly. And I have a tremendous respect for writers who can time language, right? They can use words to control the flow and the timing of how the reader receives the information. How you can space things out in a set of paragraphs or sentences so that the reader gets a particular experience, right? This is what the director and the editor do in a movie or a television show, is, you know, cut the thing together so that it creates a particular experience for the viewer. And I try to do that in novels that I write too, which is to space things, to use certain types of language and punctuation and so forth to provide the reader with a set experience that I can guide them through so that they can appreciate the humor, the revelations, you know, whatever I'm trying to convey in that particular work. Okay. So I studied how Zelazny wrote Isle of the Dead, and it enormously influenced me. And I immediately sat down and wrote the first parts of what would become Lucian, Dark God's Homecoming. Now, I have to thank my old friend Andy Roper provided the name Lucian. I knew this was a character that was going to be in some ways Satan-like. You know, he was not originally a good guy. And I'm a firm believer that any story worth itself as a story needs to be a story of character transformation. Characters should be different coming out the end of the story than they were going in. Otherwise, why bother, right? Otherwise, it's just a listing of events that happen that don't change somebody. So stories are about character and driven by character. And the story needs to produce a change in those characters as they go through that story. So I wrote Lucian, and I didn't know exactly where it was going yet, but the beginnings of the story began to come to me. And then some time passed. I didn't do very much writing at all during the mid to late 1990s. I had lots of other stuff going on in my life. I was in graduate school writing a thesis, master's thesis. I was teaching in Atlanta and then back over to Auburn doing PhD work. Then I was at Emory doing PhD work, and all of that takes enormous amounts of time and energy. And you are writing for an academic audience, and writing for an academic audience is very different. In fact, I remember one of the first papers that I wrote at Emory for a history professor there, she gave it back to me, and one of her criticisms was that it was written too much as an entertainment. In other words, that it was written with what she called elegant substitution, that I was using words, using language that suited a novel or a story, but not an academic paper. And that struck me as, well, sad for academic writing and papers, But I took her advice, and so there for a while I was writing in a very academic tone, which would not have worked very well for entertainment at all. By the time I put graduate school finally behind me, it was 1999. And so by the year 2000 or thereabouts, I was back writing again, and did some stuff for Platinum Comics, which ultimately didn't really go anywhere, but gave me some interesting exposure talking to the editors there. And for a while, it seemed like I might actually have something in development, which would have been amazing. Then 9/11 happened and things got derailed again. So it really wasn't until probably about 2002 that I remember, or somewhere back in that time, that my friend Keith DeCandido, who was editing a variety of books for various publishers at that time, he was putting together an anthology of sort of novellas, long short stories, novelettes maybe. And so I compiled my various thoughts on the Lucian character and his world into a long short story, Lucian, Dark God's Homecoming, also called, I think at that time, Sympathy for the Devil, which was basically what was happening in the story, that you had sympathy for the main character who was essentially a devil. And it didn't end up making the cut, and it didn't deserve to, but it, again, set me moving forward on that universe. Now, I have to throw in, because I totally forgot, that around 1992, I did end up writing Seeds of Empire over again as a much more grown-up novel. It still was not in publishable form by anybody's standards. And I understand that now and have for some time. And I sent it off, I think, to some publishers too, and also got rejected as well. But I knew all this time that I was not ready. I could sense it. I could tell that I was not yet ready for the big leagues by any means. I felt like I was developing my skills during the 90s when I was able to write here and there. I was reading a lot and learning a lot about writing. Just the tiny mechanical processes, the different ways of saying he said, the different ways of conveying timing. So all through the 90s, I was just sort of incubating my skills, not really working on them so much, not by actual writing, but just sort of refining them mentally. And you wouldn't think that would have worked. I wouldn't have thought it would, but just reading a lot of stuff and studying it without actually writing very much still seemed to have a pretty profound impact on how I wrote. And so when I came back to it in the early 2000s, first with the long short story, Lucian, Dark God's Homecoming, and then later with the novel, I felt a lot more comfortable. I felt like I really knew what I was doing for once. So Lucian ended up becoming a novel that I completed in mid-2004. Again, sent it off to one publisher. It was rejected. I really still didn't understand the whole concept that you have to send a book out to about a million publishers and get rejected 2 million times before anything ever catches on. So I decided just to press forward in other ways. And so Lucian sort of sat there for a little while waiting to be revived, while I then went off and revived the superhero universe with my friend Bobby Polite, the Sentinels. And so for a while there, all I was writing was the Sentinels, and that was fantastic. It let me learn even more. I learned a great deal writing When Strikes the Warlord, and I've rewritten that book 100 times. I'm still not entirely satisfied with how it's written, but people seem to like it, so I should just leave it alone. But then in 2009, Lucian was picked up by Airship 27 Productions and published by them. And I was very, very happy that it could finally find an audience, which it did, and it's done very well and gotten great reviews, which is very gratifying. It makes me feel like I knew what I was doing as far back as 2002, 2003, 2004 when I wrote it. That book, by the way, was written when I was working 13-hour days. I'd work an 8.5-hour day at the Gwinnett Hospital in Atlanta. I would then teach for about four and a half hours, several classes at night. I would get done about 9 or 10 o'clock. If it was a little earlier than that, maybe like 8, I would run over to Barnes & Noble or Borders, and I would sit there and write on Lucian for an hour or two or how much ever time before they close. They usually would have to kick me out. And so I would work on it then, and it took quite a while to come together, but eventually it did. And Lucian really sort of laid down the foundations for what would become my science fiction universe, heavily influenced by Roger Zelazny, because Lucian, like Zelazny's work, features a seemingly immortal protagonist who's not entirely a good guy, with rivals who are also seemingly immortal around him, who are also sort of shades of gray. You know, some of them are good, or none of them seem particularly good. Some of them are better or worse than the others, all working for their own selfish ends. And so that book lay that whole universe down, and also the science fiction future universe that is the background of it, because I didn't want these sort of cosmic beings interacting with today's Earth. I wanted them interacting with sort of a far future, high-tech, science fictional Earth and the empire it had carved out, the Terran Alliance at that time. So the Lucian novel introduces all those ideas and sets up that there are both good and bad guys in both the godly realm, which later I came to call the above, and the mortal realm. So, during those years, other things came along that influenced me. I wrote all of this actually before I read any of the cross-gen comics like The First and Negation and Crux, which sort of go the same, you know, they cover some of the same ground that I had covered in Lucian, where you have this sort of immortal cast of characters in again, but it's contemporary, it's not in the future, which is what I wanted to do was the future, a sort of future history that also involved, you know, demigods and godly characters. Throw into the mix, I think you cannot leave out the impact first of Jim Starlin, things like The Metamorphosis Odyssey in Epic Magazine, and then his follow-up to that, Dreadstar, the graphic novel. Not so much the comic book, because it really did become sort of a superhero comic book when it became a series, but just the Dreadstar graphic novel and The Metamorphosis Odyssey before it profoundly impacted me. The idea of destroying an entire galaxy, the idea we have to destroy it in order to save it. By the time you've read the Shattering Trilogy, you will understand how deeply Jim Starlin affected me. And also the idea that he loved of the nihilists, right? These characters who revel in destruction for destruction's sake. They don't have an agenda of conquest so much as just an agenda of destruction, of despising, you know, existence and humanity and wanting to eliminate it all. So, that was all profoundly impactful. Also, Christopher Moeller's Shadow Empires, the Faith Conquers miniseries he did for Dark Horse. Later, he did another miniseries called Shiva's War for an imprint. I think it was Helix imprint of DC, but it's the same universe. That was very influential. The big Armored Legions. Armored Legions carries us right over into me discovering the Black Library and Warhammer 40,000, and then, of course, the Horus Heresy. Enormously influential. Certainly Graham McNeil's A Thousand Suns novel, where he has legions of soldiers clashing, you know, which is throughout the entire Horus Heresy series. Certainly Dan Abnett's books along those lines were very impactful. But A Thousand Suns in particular, I think, heavily shaped in particular the second volume of the Shattering Trilogy, and I have to acknowledge that. and Dan Abnett's Horus Rising, the first volume in the Horus Heresy, which is absolutely brilliant. I've said this elsewhere, I think talking to Josh Reynolds in our Warhammer 40,000 two-part episode here, just how, you know, influential that really was to me. Then a little bit later, I discovered Peter F. Hamilton. The British science fiction writers I've come to appreciate a lot, much more than I previously did. You know, there are certain things about British science fiction, cultural, social things that come across very strongly that I don't like as much, but there are also a lot of things to be said positively for them, things that I think a lot of American science fiction has been missing and lacking in recent years, ever since probably the late 70s, early 80s. And Peter F. Hamilton's big, giant science fiction epics not only tell a humongous saga of a story, which I appreciate, but also lay out all sorts of fascinating, kind of semi-hard SF technological and military ideas that I immediately tried to incorporate bits and pieces of into my work as well. So, and then of course, Jack Kirby, the whole larger-than-life flavor that Kirby brought to everything he did, had an influence, not, I don't think, as much specifically in a lot of cases, as just overall in general, in the background, the tone, the that everything is big and bold and dramatic and larger than life. That was very, I think, influential on me. So, you know, so anyway, so that's some of the influences. And then, so after I wrote Lucian, I had been already working on, probably around 2005, I had the idea of a sort of extremely post-apocalyptic, quote-unquote, shattered galaxy, where lawlessness prevailed, where all the old empires had completely fallen and been broken down by some outside invasion, and really the only law and order that was existing in the galaxy was brought about by a vast computer intelligence called the Machine, who recruited or created or otherwise put into service what were called hands of the Machine. The idea of hand, of course, comes from George R. R. Martin's Game of Thrones Song of Ice and Fire series, where the king has a nobleman who acts to enforce his decisions in court, sort of Sheriff of Nottingham way. And so I thought, the Machine, being sort of the king, but not able to go out on its own and do things, would want to have human judgment. It wouldn't send robots out, but it would want them firmly under its control. And so these hands of the Machine are human agents entirely at the service of the Machine, though to what degree of entirely at the Machine's service, of course, is a plot point to be addressed. And they would be going out sort of like the Lone Ranger, just them and their intelligent ship, which that was probably influenced by Star-Lord, the original, not the Guardians of the Galaxy, Dan Abnett movie Star-Lord, but the original 1970s, cosmic Star-Lord from Marvel, largely from the black and white magazines, Marvel, I think, Preview, perhaps. So, as I worked on that later on, toward the end, Justified came along, and Timothy Oliphant's character struck me as another sort of the lone lawman out in a lawless area, that being part of Kentucky, and his black Lincoln Town Car being the sentient ship in this case. And so, again, lots of little things that are parallel, that influence these ideas, and Hawk took a long time to write because I kept changing my mind as to exactly what it needed to be. There was a period where I wanted him to be like a James Ellroy character. There was a period where I wanted him to be like a Donald Westlake character, like a Parker perhaps, but on the good side. You know, different ideas kept coming to me that caused me to revamp this character. And ultimately, I read enough Warhammer, Black Library stuff, that I decided to just make him a sort of a pulpy science fiction standard hero. You know, his part of his character had always been that he had lost his memory. And I came up with that about the same time that the modern version of Ultra in the Sentinels books came along. So it's not that I did one and then the other and I was being derivative of my own work. I kind of did them parallel, and that idea became critically important to both characters, so I couldn't really leave it out of either one. It really is who they are, is that they didn't know who they were. That's who they are. So Hawk took a lot of the background. I think, in fact, I would argue that probably the single most important, significant moment in this entire process of writing this sort of science fiction series that I'm talking about here, the single pivotal moment was when I made the decision that Hawk's universe is the same universe as Lucian's, but later. And the object, the sort of MacGuffin that I threw in that anchors the two into the same universe is the big golden sword of Baranak. It shows up in Hawk, and of course it's prominent through Lucian. And so once that decision was made, I realized I really was telling one big story just in different places and times, and that I had actually begun two series rather than Hawk and Lucian being two books in a single series. They're two books in a single universe, but they're not exactly in the same series. And so then I realized that what needed to be done was that they needed to be connected in a stronger way through a chain of events of history rather than just through an artifact turning up, you know, randomly in both. And so what I needed, I slowly realized, was a third series that tied those two together. And of course, the great irony of this is that I have now almost at this time that I'm recording this, I've almost completed writing the entire trilogy that connects those two books together without having written another Hawk book or another Lucian book. So after I wrote Lords of Fire, I realized I had actually written the first volume in three different series. That's not a good way to attract readers. Readers want to get part two and part three and part four. They don't want to get part one, and now here's another part one, now here's another part one. So that was sort of funny, but I think now that this middle trilogy is about done, The Shattering, which explains how we got from Lucian to Hawk, more or less, now that it's about done, I think that, you know, I'll be able to hopefully add on to the Lucian side of the equation and to the Hawk side of the equation, and each of those will develop independently but continue to be so intimately related and tied together in their mythology, in their backgrounds, and to some degree or another with their characters, but I won't go any further into that right now. Okay, so that was Hawk, and so I decided I needed to write a series that gave the background, that gave the connecting tissue between the two, as I said. And I had a few ideas floating around, but I knew that the thing needed to end with the shattering of the galaxy. Now, that put me in sort of the same position that I guess George Lucas found himself in doing the prequel trilogy to Star Wars, which is that you have a predetermined ending and you have to get to it in a way that's still entertaining and positive, even though you know where things are ultimately going and you can't avoid it. So I started mapping out some ideas and some characters. I sat down with the brilliant pulp writer Wayne Reinagle, who lives in a nearby town to mine. We sat down over nachos at an Irish pub, and we talked about it a bit, and I gave him some of my ideas and ran through them, and we talked about it. And I left with several pages of notes I'd come up with, and I sort of ran from there. Now, originally I had envisioned 10 volumes of this series. I am kind of ambitious. I scaled that back to where actually each book now has, each volume has four books in it. So the series has turned out to be 12 books, not 10, but each of those books is only a quarter of an actual novel. They're really like part one, part two, part three, part four of each of those three novels. So Lords of Fire, Sons of Terra, Kings of Oblivion. I'll give you a little more inside baseball on that. I had the names together of 10 legions. Some of them I liked, some of them I thought were weaker, but it's hard to come up with 10 really good names, you know, especially sitting there in an afternoon. I thought Lords of Fire was pretty good. I think the second one was Sand Kings, and of course that turns up in Volume 2. I think the third one at that time was Sons of Terra, and I liked that a lot. And then there were several others, but not Kings of Oblivion. And so I ended up sort of choosing the ones I thought were the strongest to use actually in the books, and that became Lords of Fire, Sand Kings, Sons of Terra, and Golden Phalanx. Those are the ones that survived into the books. The others are cast aside. Maybe they'll show up later. Who knows? And I restructured things into three volumes. Lords of Fire being the first, focusing more on Tamerlane. Ezekiel, Marcus Ezekiel Tamerlane. The second volume, Sons of Terra, now moved from 3 to 2. And Sons of Terra focusing largely on this new character I had, Ione Iapetus, who was the hard-nosed, tough, rough, no-nonsense commander of the fanatical defenders of the Earth, the defenders of Terra, Sons of Terra. And then I needed a similar construction for the third volume's title. And I racked my brains, as they say, trying to think of something, because I had called his army, his legion, the Golden Phalanx. And I like that name, and it is apt to a big blonde-headed guy. But I wanted it to be a parallel grammatical construction. Lords of Fire, Sons of Terra. So I needed something that was laudable, like lords or sons, and I needed them to be of something. And finally, I hit upon Kings of Oblivion, not even remembering at the time that I had seen that phrase before somewhere, because it is the name of a song from Def Leppard. So I had that CD and didn't even realize that there was a Kings of Oblivion song. But it's kind of cool that one of my books, one of my legions, has its own song from Def Leppard. That's cool. I'll take that. So then I just had to break the story out over three volumes, figure out what needed to happen in each one. And because Lucian now took place much earlier in the timeline of this universe, and that after Lucian's book, the gods, the remaining gods, sort of scatter, and to some degree the main villainous gods in Lucian are defeated and are gone by the end of that book. I don't think that's too much of a spoiler to say. I didn't really have a villain left to use in The Shattering. When I wrote Hawk, I had brought in a new god, not one of Jack Kirby's new gods, but a god that was new for me. I enjoy creating these godly characters, by the way. Making up their names is so much fun, and often I'll make up their names first, and the sound of their names will influence what I decide their sort of, as I say, their portfolio is, right? Are they, you know, god of battle, god of persuasion, god of mischief and evil? You know, their name seems to lend itself to that. And I let them, you know, sometimes I work backwards. I need a god who will be the god of something, and I'll come up with the name that sort of fits that. But it seems to work better to actually come up with a name first and just make a whole list of names, and then sort of look for the one that sounds like he would or she would be what I'm looking for from the list. So that's where Garadin came from. I needed somebody. I actually kind of reverse engineered him because I needed a villain. I needed a villain that would be a god and that never showed up in Lucian. If I could go back and reissue Lucian, I would drop Garadin in here and there. That's the one thing I really regret, is that he was made up for Hawk and, of course, is in the Shattering, but is not in Lucian. So we kind of have to just assume that he was off stage doing other things during Lucian, and that's how he, for one thing, that's how he survived the events of Lucian, because clearly Baranak would have beheaded him with one stroke of the sword of Baranak if he had gotten a chance, if he had known, you know, what was going to happen. So I had Garadin as my sort of main overarching villain, and then I needed some smaller villains, and Ramesses came along as well as others. And Barmakid and so forth. So I've, you know, thrown various villains in along the way. But the story remained, I think, focused on sort of the rise of Tamerlane and Agrippa, and to a certain degree Iapetus, and how they sort of orbited one another as fellow officers on the rise during these sort of apocalyptic times. You know, if Hawk is my post-apocalyptic novel, then this trilogy is certainly my apocalyptic, because you see it. And that was always the plan. So, some of the things that you find, and I'll be moving toward a close now, because we've kind of traveled the history of these books to where they came from, and I don't want to give too much away about the books themselves. But like I say, if you want to understand the story, Lucian is the beginning. It set everything up. Hawk is, as of now, the ending, though I plan to do more. And the Shattering is sort of in the middle. And for those that haven't read them, briefly, without spoilers too much, Lords of Fire is about how Marcus Ezekiel Tamerlane, who was an orphan, essentially raised by General Hideo Nakamura of the First Legion of the Human Empire, how Tamerlane has been disgraced, to some degree on purpose, by the emperor he serves, and redeems himself and comes back, and the emperor and his entourage travel off into the above, very foolhardily. And so Nakamura and Tamerlane lead a team that goes in to try to find them and rescue them and bring them back. There's a lot of negative zone sort of stuff from the old Fantastic Four, I think, that you could see influences of in that part too, as well as something like Event Horizon and the Warhammer stuff. And so the rest of Lords of Fire deals with the repercussions of that, and it's got some of my favorite moments and scenes I've ever written in it. I'm really proud of that book, and I'm also very, very proud that it was a finalist for both the Pulp Factory Awards for Best Novel of the Year and the New Pulp Awards for Best Novel of the Year. I know as of this recording that it did not win Best Novel from the New Pulp Awards, but I still cross my fingers and hold out hope that when I go to Windy City Pulp and Paperback Convention in Chicago in April, that, who knows, maybe it actually will have won. That would be awesome. I doubt it. It's up against really tough competition, but it's got a chance, and so we'll see what happens. But that would be so awesome to actually receive the accolades and the approval of my peers in this sort of new pulp field. So that would be great. But, you know, we'll see. I still, I feel like it does have some of my strongest writing. The second book, Sons of Terra, the shift focuses more to Iapetus and his fanatical legion. And I honestly think that my writing in it is even better. I'm just as pleased with that book and more pleased in some ways with it. I'm really looking forward to hearing reviews come in on Sons of Terra. So if you've read it, please either post a review on Amazon or at least drop me an email or tweet or something on Facebook and let me know what you thought about it, because I feel pretty good about it. I feel like I accomplished what I wanted to accomplish in Sons of Terra. And it took about 7 or 8 months to write that whole book. That was a tough one, but I think it was worth it. And now Kings of Oblivion focuses again largely on Agrippa. And Agrippa is a character that emerged, unexpectedly. To some degree, There is an analog of him in the Hawk novel that was very popular. People liked, and I enjoyed writing him. So in the Shattering trilogy, Agrippa has been very popular. I've had people specifically on Twitter that I don't even know tweeting me, telling me how much they like Agrippa and don't let anything happen to him. I better not kill him off. And so his role became more and more prominent. And of course, he takes center stage in this book named after his legion, the Golden Phalanx, whose nickname and therefore the title of the book is The Kings of Oblivion. So Kings of Oblivion has required a couple of things to happen. It put me in the position where I knew how the ending had to go. I had to write to the ending. That's not always an easy thing to do. It's difficult because stories want to go where they want to go. If you try to force them, you can really mess them up. So I had to let Kings of Oblivion grow as a book the way it wanted to grow, let the characters do what they normally would do as actual characters and not be forced. And yet I needed the story to end up where it had to end up. So that's quite a challenge. And I feel like, it's worked out pretty darn well. I'm almost finished with the first draft of it as of today. And we'll see when I go through the rewrites how good it looks. It largely was set up in the second book, and it plays out. It brings in a lot of characters from the other books. It sort of wraps everything up, brings everything together. The other book I've done that I would think that it reminds me of in that way is Stellarax, the Sixth Sentinels book. Because with the Sixth Sentinels novel, Stellarax, I knew going in that this was it. This was the end of the big story to that point, and it had certain things it had to accomplish. It couldn't end on a cliffhanger. It couldn't have things held over to the next book because there was not a next book in that storyline. The next book was going to start a new trilogy. So, very similar to Stellarax, Kings of Oblivion has to both be a contained story in itself and wrap up the larger trilogy story preparatory to the coming of the Hawk series. So, and I'll say right now that for the first time I'm feeling today like there probably is another book, at least one, that needs to happen between Kings of Oblivion and Hawk. I kind of have a vision of what that book needs to be. I think it would be really fun. I think people would really like it. And so I guess I'm going to start plotting that one out now. I do need to write the next Sentinels book, and that will be coming along soon. But I also think that the new, that this other idea is certainly worth sitting down and thinking about. And so I'll do up probably a 2 or 3 page general plot summary. Now, I'll kind of wrap up by saying this. This is how I work mechanically with things like this. When an idea for a book or a series strikes me, I'll generally type up maybe a 2, 3, 4 page, 5 page general outline, maybe specific descriptions of a few key scenes, because when I think of a storyline, it tends to come to me not only as an overall storyline, but also certain very visual moments, sort of visual highlights within the series. And, I very clearly see those moments, in my head, and I write towards them, hoping that I will hit them and that they won't be forced. If they're forced, I don't do them. I change them. I don't ever put out a substandard product if I can help it, at least in my own judgment. But I write toward those scenes, and if it all goes well, it goes well. If not, I change it or delete it. When I have these plots put together with certain key scenes included, I usually let it sit for a while. I think about it here and there, maybe before I go to bed or when I'm in the shower, various times when everything's kind of calm and peaceful and you're within your own head more and you can kind of focus. And so I'll think about things, maybe driving in the car. I'll think about these things and maybe new scenes or better ideas will come to me. And so by the time I actually write the book that original document is very obsolete, but the core of it is usually still there. Usually I've added a lot more embellishment. I've developed a lot of ideas. As you write a book, you outgrow the plot very quickly. The characters will develop themselves and they will begin to dictate what happens. And so, that always tends to happen, and it shapes stories the way that they organically need to go, and that's fine. And so you have to be adaptable enough to go with the flow. You know, I get joked with and kidded about many times about how big my outlines and plots are going in. But I want my fellow creators and readers out there to understand I don't stick religiously to them. They're flexible. You know, they're made to be bent and broken. They give me a roadmap of kind of where I want to go, but it's like a map that says drive from New York to Los Angeles. What route I take to get there can vary tremendously. And once I get to the end, I throw the map away and look at what I've actually done, which is usually very different. So the organic and mechanical process of writing the book generally always deviates wildly from the map. From the outline going in, but you still get to the destination you wanted to get to if everything has gone well. So, all right. So hopefully that gives you some sort of behind the scenes inner thoughts and look at how I come up with this stuff, at what I've been doing with this sort of science fiction part of my writing. I might come back and do the same sort of program in the future talking about the Sentinels. But I just felt like people know about the Sentinels. They have a pretty good idea what's going on there. My science fiction novels don't have quite the exposure yet. In some ways, it's because they have to compete with a lot more other works and authors. When I started writing the Sentinels, there were not a whole lot of original superhero novels being done. Not very many at all. Just a handful. And so they were able to sort of carve out their own niche very early on, back around 2005. Doing space opera, military science fiction, there's a lot of competition out there to have to cut through to get your message out and to get people to try it. So I'll wrap up simply by saying, if you are one of my listeners, I always appreciate that, and hope you'll tune in again next time, when I'll obviously have a guest on again to talk about some topic. But if you're one of my readers of my books, understand how much I value and appreciate you tremendously. Doing what I do, spending untold hours in seclusion typing on a keyboard, it's critical to believe that there are people out there who appreciate it and value it and want you to continue, because otherwise, why even do it? And I have to believe that what I'm doing is good and worthwhile and that people enjoy it, because again, if not, why even do it other than for myself? And so thank you so much for reading my stuff, and thank you so much for listening today. I hope this hasn't been too incredibly boring for you. Maybe you've found some things of interest, and next week we will be back to our normal format. So the rocket is going to get on out of here, and I'm going to go type the rest of Kings of Oblivion now. So thanks again for listening, and we will see you down the road.
Griffin, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.